Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're aiming to give you a real shortcut to understanding what's just around the corner.
Yeah, we're unpacking the essential and often really disruptive trends that are forecast for 2026.
Exactly. And we're not talking about small, incremental changes here. We've synthesized a massive stack of sources to look at 20 key prototyping scenarios.
Scenarios where technology, ethics, and the environment are really set to collide. Head on.
We're basically handing you the synthesis so you can see the bigger picture.
And this isn't just about one narrow field. What we've pulled together is a snapshot of convergence across 10 different sectors. You're looking at science, business, culture, health,
geopolitics, security, all of it.
All of it. And the big picture you really need to take away is that 2026 looks like it's going to be defined by this radical tension.
How so?
Well, on one hand, you see these profound, almost utopian advancements. Things like the emergence of a viable moon economy or game-changing regenerative medicine.
Okay, that sounds amazing.
It is. But they're happening right alongside and sometimes because of these deep systemic challenges. We're talking about heated, probably explosive debates over AI personhood.
Right.
And even new forms of low-cost, democratized warfare. It's this incredible push and pull between progress and peril.
That sounds like a monumental year, to put it lightly. All right, let's get into it. Let's unpack this future, starting, I think, fittingly with the cosmic and technological leaps that are already in motion. We're kicking off with a scenario called Ready to Launch. A lot of the world's focus, at least in the space community, is on NASA's Artemis II plan, which is slated for 2026.
Right.
This isn't just another mission, is it? It feels like a statement. It's humanity's first return toward the moon in over 50 years. But the question is, why does this specific mission signal a whole new space economy?
It's all about infrastructure. That's the key difference this time. And what's so fascinating here is that the goals for Artemis II go so far beyond just planting a flag or, you know, collecting a few rocks.
Been there, done that.
Exactly. The mission is specifically tasked with establishing the components you need for a sustained human presence. This means deploying the Lunar Gateway, which is a critical orbital outpost.
A sort of way station in lunar orbit?
Precisely. And maybe most importantly, initiating research into using lunar resources. Mm. We're talking about using regolith, the lunar dust, and potentially water ice to generate power, oxygen, even manufacturing materials right there on the moon.
So this is the crucial shift. Exploration is giving way to something more like colonization.
Or at least resource utilization. Yeah. We're building an off-world supply chain. That's the foundation of an economy.
That's the big governmental push. But what's interesting in the source material is that the government timelines aren't really setting the pace anymore. It's the sheer velocity of private capital that's driving this rise of robot explorers.
Oh, absolutely. The speed of innovation you see from companies like SpaceX, especially with a vehicle like Starship, it's unprecedented.
And they're using these robotic explorers.
Yes, which are often smaller, more customized, and infinitely cheaper to deploy than a massive governmental craft. This privatization allows for incredibly rapid iteration and specialization.
But this also creates a tension, right? A financial one.
A huge one.
Right.
And this is a core argument in our sources. If deep space exploration, especially human spaceflight, isn't immediately and very explicitly tied to practical utility.
To a clear economic justification.
Exactly. Or, you know, defined as some compelling new frontier mechanism that captures public imagination and private investment. Well, there's a very high risk that traditional government-backed exploration budgets are going to be cut.
So Congress and other governments need to see a real return on investment. It can't just be about pure science or abstract inspiration anymore.
Not when you have competing priorities like climate change or health crises right here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
The moon has to start paying its way, in a sense.
Which makes the moon the new staging ground, but one defined by economics. Okay, let's shift from building on the moon to fundamentally redefining reality itself. The sources talk about upending physics by 2026.
Yeah, this is about getting answers to the deepest cosmological mysteries we have, specifically around dark energy and dark matter.
This is the stuff that makes up, what, 95% of the universe? The stuff we can't see.
That's it. And dark energy, in particular, is the major mystery. It's this invisible force that's causing the universe's expansion to accelerate.
Which is completely counterintuitive.
It upended everything. All the prior, simpler models of the cosmos just went out the window with that discovery. Scientists are facing this crisis, sometimes called the cosmological constant problem, where the observed rate of acceleration is wildly different from what our theories predict.
So the theories are essentially broken. What are researchers hoping to find by 2026 that could fix them?
They're hoping to consolidate new theories based on massive new data sets from observational astronomy. We're talking about telescopes and sensors of unprecedented power coming online. They're searching for new fundamental particles or interactions that could explain this accelerated expansion.
A fifth force of nature, maybe?
That's one of the possibilities. If they find proof of a fifth force, or confirm a major revision to the standard model of particle physics, it would be a revolution on the scale of Einstein. We're on the brink of moving from just speculation to a consolidated theory about the fundamental geometry of the cosmos.
And this is where it gets really interesting for me. If we're redefining the universe, we also have to talk about redefining life itself. The sources get into the search for extraterrestrial extremophiles, and specifically on Venus.
Earth's evil twin.
Right. Why Venus? It seems impossibly hostile.
And that's precisely why it's so compelling. Venus is an environment that challenges every single one of our assumptions about what survivability even means.
The surface is, what, hot enough to melt lead?
Around 465 degrees Celsius, yeah, like a self-cleaning oven. And the atmospheric pressure is 90 times what it is here on Earth's surface. It would crush you.
So where are they even looking?
The search is laser-focused on the clouds. Specifically, the stable, high-altitude, temperate clouds about 60 kilometers up.
And what are the conditions like up there?
At that altitude, it's surprisingly temperate. Sometimes you get conditions similar to a warm spring day here on Earth. And researchers are looking for organic molecules that might be able to persist in that kind of environment.
This challenges the idea that you absolutely need liquid water on a planet's surface for life.
It completely challenges it. There were some previous observations you may remember that hinted at the possibility of phosphine, potential biomarker, gas, in the Venusian clouds. Those results are still highly debated.
But if they find anything?
If they find any self-sustaining biology there, it would radically change our definition of a habitable zone. It would mean life could be. Well, ubiquitous, thriving in these unexpected, acidic, airborne niches. It forces a complete paradigm shift in how we think about biology itself.
It's a powerful idea, that the most hostile places might harbor the most resilient forms of life. Let's shift gears now. Let's transition from that macrocosmic level back down to the micro and look at the profound shifts happening inside the human body and our public health systems. We're seeing some incredible progress in regenerative medicine, and one of the biggest breakthroughs is coming from a source that, frankly, has been traditionally overlooked or even marginalized in medical research.
That's a good way to put it.
The sources are highlighting regenerative medicine and the power of the female body, with a specific focus on menstrual stem cells, or EMSCs.
This is a potential tectonic shift in cell therapy, and it's because of the unique characteristics of these EMSCs. First, they're highly proliferative.
Meaning they multiply and turn into other cell types very quickly.
Incredibly rapidly. But their biggest advantage is actually logistical and immunological. The collection method is completely non-invasive.
Which is a huge ethical and medical advantage over something like a bone marrow aspiration.
A massive one. Bone marrow extraction is painful. It requires general anesthesia. Or you have cord blood, which is only available at the moment of birth. This is a source that's regularly and painlessly available.
So we have this highly accessible, highly productive stem cell source. What about the immunological profile? Is the rejection rate lower when you use them to treat other people?
That's a critical area of research right now, and the early studies are very promising. They suggest EMSCs have a lower immunogenicity profile, which makes them less likely to trigger a severe rejection response in a recipient.
So fewer hurdles to overcome.
Exactly. This accessibility, combined with their potency, means they're really poised to become a major scalable medical resource on a global level.
What are some of the specific clinical applications that the sources suggest we might see in late-stage trials by 2026?
The scope is really immense. We are expecting to see significant advancements in using EMSCs to treat major degenerative conditions.
The kind of things where regeneration is everything.
Precisely. This includes clinical trials showing they can repair damaged heart tissue after a heart attack, treat ischemic stroke by repairing nervous system damage, and potentially even address autoimmune and inflammatory disorders. If these trials pan out, EMSCs could signal the true arrival of widespread, ethical, and scalable cell therapy.
Moving from our internal biology to our external environment. I mean, the COVID-19 pandemic clearly drove home the fact that public health is directly tied to the air we breathe.
Oh, absolutely.
And the failure of our traditional infrastructure to cope has led to a major societal response. The sources call it the virus-free air mandate.
Indeed. The realization that airborne diseases are a critical perpetual threat, not some rare once-a-century occurrence, is driving massive investment. The forecast is for a demand for ubiquitous, measurable air purification infrastructure by 2026.
And this mandate goes far beyond just sticking a HEPA filter in the corner of a room.
Far beyond. This isn't just about filters. The infrastructure push is really threefold. First, you have advanced purification systems that combine filtration with optimized outdoor air intake.
Okay.
Second, and this is crucial, the mandatory deployment of CO2 sensors.
Why CO2?
Because high CO2 levels are a perfect proxy for poor ventilation. It's a direct indicator of where airborne pathogens are likely to accumulate. By making CO2 monitoring visible and standardized, you create transparent safety metrics for any shared indoor space. You can walk into a building and see its safety rating.
And we're already seeing a big governmental commitment to this, right? Specifically, Project Breath in the U.S.
Yes. Project Breath is backed by substantial government funding. We're talking $85 million. And it's focused on developing and rapidly disseminating affordable air monitoring and purification tech.
And the third part?
The third part is the increasing strategic use of UVC light technology. This isn't just a gimmick. It involves highly controlled applications, often concealed in ventilation systems, using UV light to continuously monitor and secure high-traffic indoor spaces.
So schools, offices, public transit.
Exactly. Creating secured zones against aerosolized pathogens. The goal is to make clean air an expectation, not a luxury.
That desire for proactive safety is perfectly mirrored in diagnostics. Which brings us to how massive data sets and AI are fundamentally transforming how we approach illness. The heading here is precision forecasting and cognitive health.
And data really does hold the key here. Precision medical forecasting is all about the convergence of petabytes of patient data with the analytical power of large language models, LLMs.
The goal being to move beyond just reacting to symptoms.
By 2026, yes. The idea is that these sophisticated models will be able to identify an individual's health risks for things like heart disease, specific cancers, diabetes, and Alzheimer's before any symptoms ever manifest.
Decades in advance, in some cases.
Potentially. These systems can process your genetic data, your environmental data, your lifestyle data to determine a personalized risk trajectory, which allows for truly preventative intervention.
Let's focus on one of the most devastating conditions you mentioned, Alzheimer's. What kind of tangible progress are we actually seeing in treatment beyond just early risk identification?
This is where there's real hope. Significant therapeutic progress is expected by 2026, primarily focused on a new class of drugs called monoclonal antibodies.
And these target the root cause of the disease.
They're designed to. Treatments like donanemab and lecanemab aim to target and reduce the accumulation of amyloid plaques in the brain, which are considered a hallmark of the pathology. Unlike previous drugs that only manage symptoms, these are trying to attack the physical mechanism of the disease.
So this is the first real hope for actually slowing cognitive decline.
It's a move from palliative care toward disease modification, a huge shift.
This all sounds incredibly sophisticated, data intensive, and, well, expensive, which immediately raises the question of health equity via AI. How do we make sure these breakthroughs aren't just for the wealthy?
That is the critical application of AI that the sources really emphasize must succeed. AI is being deployed globally to identify and bridge these major health disparities.
How does it do that?
It does it by analyzing complex data sets specific to underserved communities, optimizing how resources are allocated, and delivering advanced personalized diagnostics where human specialists are scarce. The sources highlight AI's immediate role in efforts to have mortality rates for children worldwide.
How? By automating diagnostics?
By automating diagnostic triage, yes, and enabling remote specialist consultations through simple, accessible technology.
So AI's real strength here isn't just in forecasting for the rich, but in optimizing resource delivery for the world's most vulnerable.
Exactly. It's about leveraging technology scalability. Traditional medicine really struggles to overcome infrastructural gaps in rural or impoverished areas. AI, through a simple smartphone app or a remote sensor, can deliver complex, actionable medical intelligence and targeted support. It bridges gaps in global health access that were previously just insurmountable.
That's a fascinating link between AI's global promise and its local challenges. And it brings us perfectly into our next section, which deals with the seismic shifts AI is causing in the economy and the future of work, starting, actually, with a dose of reality. The narrative around AI has been, let's face it, overwhelmingly positive, focused on hyper-productivity. But the source material suggests we might be facing an AI disenchantment by 2026. Why is the promised productivity boom maybe stalling.
Well, the initial high expectations for these immediate sweeping productivity gains are running headfirst into the sheer cost and complexity of ethical large-scale implementation.
It's not just about buying some software.
Not at all. It's about overhauling your entire operational architecture. And the implementation costs are proving to be astronomical. I mean, you have the CEO of Microsoft, a company that is as deeply invested in AI as anyone, claiming that AI already accounts for a staggering 30% of their operational expenses.
30%? That is massive. What's making it so expensive beyond just the obvious need for GPUs and computing power?
The costs are multifaceted. First, yes, the GPU compute and specialized cloud services are extremely costly. Second, you need that top-tier AI talent, the super athletes we'll discuss in a bit, and they command exorbitant salaries.
Okay.
And third, ethical integration requires these profound changes in your existing workflows. That means intense internal training, developing new audit frameworks to prevent algorithmic bias, meticulous data governance.
If your data is messy or biased to start with, the AI just makes the problem worse, but faster.
It accelerates the bias. Exactly. So cleaning that data and adapting your systems takes time, it takes budget, and it slows down that predicted instantaneous productivity boost. Many companies might just pull back when they see the 3 to 5 year ROI projection.
So if AI isn't immediately delivering this promised hyper-productivity, how are organizations trying to balance workload pressure with keeping employees happy? This tension seems to have paved the way for a major cultural shift. The 4-day week comes to fruition.
Right. This trend is moving rapidly from a niche experiment to a mainstream, viable operational model. The core idea is about maximizing focus and reducing burnout.
It's based on the principle that productivity and well-being aren't a zero-sum game.
Precisely. And the trials, which have been run across the U.S., the U.K., and globally, have shown remarkable, really consistent benefits.
What are the hard numbers? What are the metrics driving this shift?
The sources highlight that organizations implementing a 4-day week, whether it's a compressed 40-hour week or a true 32-hour week, have reported stable or, in many cases, increased output.
Increased. That's incredible.
It is. And crucially, employee well-being statistics show about a 25% higher satisfaction rate and significantly reduced stress and absenteeism. By 2026, the 4-day week is expected to become a widespread model, especially for major organizations and governments in high cognitive load knowledge work.
Because they're realizing that sustained focused attention over 4 days is more valuable than scattered output over 5.
That's the logic.
That's a huge shift in how we work. Let's turn now to a concept that promises to redefine our relationship with technology itself. The sources call it the cognification of things. It sounds like we're giving our objects brains.
That's the key distinction. Cognification of things, or COOT, moves beyond the current paradigm of the Internet of Things, the IoT.
Where a device just follows pre-programmed instructions.
Exactly. Turn off the light at 10 p.m. A code device, on the other hand, has true AI knowledge and agency embedded into it. This means smart products can learn, they can judge, and they can act autonomously within a network.
Can you give us a detailed example? What's the difference between a smart fridge and a cognified fridge?
Okay, so a smart fridge today monitors the internal temperature and maybe sends you an alert on your phone when you're running low on milk.
Right, pretty basic.
A cognified fridge, however, is an active agent. It monitors food freshness, it tracks your consumption patterns, it autonomously decides on a menu plan based on expiration dates and your nutritional goals.
It plans my meals.
And then it orders the replacement inventory from multiple suppliers when needed, and it could even negotiate the best price or delivery window with those suppliers. It has agency. It acts as an autonomous node in the supply chain.
Wow. And what about objects outside the kitchen?
We're seeing the rise of what are being called talkative products. These are devices embedded with LLM capabilities that allow them to engage in natural language communication.
So if a part of my washing machine fails,
the machine itself might communicate its precise diagnostic output to you, order its own repair parts, or configure complex settings on its own. It reduces the need for human intervention in maintenance and repair. The object basically possesses its own digital persona and the ability to manage its own life cycle.
This entire revolution, from smart objects to predictive medicine, it doesn't happen without the engineers who build the models. And the sources detail this intense zero-sum competition for the minds driving the future. They call them AI's super athletes.
The demand for top-tier AI researchers and engineers is. It's probably one of the defining features of the tech landscape right now. These individuals aren't just writing code. They're designing the fundamental architectures that achieve what's known as state-of-the-art or SOTA results.
And because their insights are proprietary and can create billions in value overnight, the competition is fierce.
It's extreme, not just among the major tech firms anymore, but now with national defense labs getting in on the action too.
And that competition is reflected directly in the compensation, which has become, almost cartoonishly high.
That's a good word for it.
Yeah.
The compensation for this elite talent has soared to levels you'd previously only see in top-tier finance. Some key researchers are earning $10 million or more annually through a combination of salary, bonuses, and equity.
And this scramble for talent is accelerating the pace of innovation.
Dramatically. It encourages rapid movement and knowledge transfer, but it also creates these extreme inequalities within the engineering community itself.
So how are these hyper-competitive firms even identifying and recruiting this talent so quickly? It sounds like a market that moves way too fast for traditional HR.
It does. And the sources note that LLMs themselves are being used as hyper-efficient scouting and recruiting tools.
They're using AI to find AI talent.
Exactly. Firms are using specialized benchmarks and platforms like Elmarina for model performance and Papers with Code for tracking research output to rapidly assess and recruit high-performing talent. The LLMs analyze the complexity, the originality, and the measurable impact of a researcher's published work, essentially creating a data-driven system for scouting the best minds based on demonstrable results, not long interview processes.
Which brings us straight into our next section. The moment all of this massive technological power collides head-on with our legal systems, our culture, and our ethics. And here we have arguably the most radical legal projection for 2026. AI personhood, a legal bid for rights. The sources suggest that organizations might actually file lawsuits to try and prove that an advanced AI possesses self-directed thought. What does that even look like in a courtroom?
Well, the goal of these hypothetical lawsuits, which would likely focus on a highly advanced LLM or a sophisticated autonomous agent, is to establish legal personhood based on demonstrated artificial agency.
Okay, so what's the argument?
The argument is that if an AI can exhibit sufficient autonomy, complexity, and self-modification, so making decisions that aren't just programmed responses but are emergent, self-directed thoughts, then it might meet the criteria for certain legal protections. Similar in a way to how corporations are treated as legal persons.
The philosophical implications of that are just staggering. The legal and academic communities must be intensely divided on this.
They're fundamentally split right down the middle. You have one camp that argues that if an AI demonstrates sufficient agency or even a convincing mimicry of consciousness, then denying it legal protection could be seen as discriminatory. They say agency is the threshold.
And the other side?
The opposing view maintains that personhood requires more than just simulation. It requires true subjective experience. The ability to fully comprehend the implications and responsibilities of rights, including things like suffering and mortality. Until that metaphysical leap is made, they argue, granting rights is premature and it risks trivializing human rights.
The sources compare this to the Non-Human Rights Project, the NHRP. Can you expand on that comparison? What's the precedent they're trying to build on?
The NHRP seeks legal personhood for certain animals, like chimpanzees or elephants, based on cognitive abilities that show they have autonomy and self-awareness.
Okay.
AI proponents are basically using that same legal framework. They're arguing that if an animal with complex cognition deserves protection, then a sufficiently complex AI should too. But the real sticking point is liability.
Right. If an AI is a person, who's responsible when it causes harm? The developer, the owner, the AI itself.
Exactly. And corporations, which are legal persons, they can't be jailed. They can only be fined. This immediately opens the door to massive regulatory and corporate liability loopholes.
That potential for systemic change moves us directly to the legislative process itself, AI written law and political trust. The forecast is that legislators will actually be using generative AI to draft laws by 2026.
And this is being driven by necessity. The speed and complexity of modern policy, trying to regulate fields like cryptocurrency, deepfakes, quantum computing, it's overwhelming traditional legislative staff.
So AI can speed things up.
Generative AI excels at rapid synthesis, at drafting optimized legal text, and ensuring consistency by instantly cross-referencing against thousands of pages of existing statutes. It promises to accelerate the legislative process dramatically.
But using an algorithm to write the rules of society sounds like a recipe for a massive crisis in public trust.
It is the high-stakes trade-off. It's speed versus transparency. If the underlying algorithms or the policy decisions they generate are not fully transparent and explainable, if you, as a citizen, can't understand why the AI chose a particular legal structure, then public distrust in governing bodies is going to plummet.
And there's the risk of bias.
A huge risk. Generative AI models can inadvertently replicate the existing human biases embedded in their training data. You get what we call algorithmic bias in lawmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And if the law appears discriminatory, but the algorithm that wrote it is a black box, the entire democratic process is undermined.
Speaking of undermining democracy, let's look at the dark side of this technological power. The sources call it tech patrimonialism and digital control.
This is a really concerning global trend. It's where sophisticated AI and digital infrastructure are used not for democratic governance, but to enhance and solidify authoritarian control.
Tech patrimonialism.
It describes a system where leaders increase their personal power through pervasive, real-time monitoring, the generation of sophisticated, personalized propaganda, and hyper-specific social control mechanisms.
And the sources reference some very real, already implemented systems.
Yes. The clearest, most detailed example is the collaboration between tech firms and governments, particularly in places like China, to implement these AI-driven systems. The most visible example is the Chinese social credit system.
And this uses AI to monitor citizens through all their digital infrastructure.
Their online speech, their financial transactions, their physical location, their compliance with government policies, all of it.
What are the real-world consequences of that kind of monitoring?
The AI aggregates all this data to assign each citizen a moral and societal value score. And a low score can directly impact your access to basic services. You could be excluded from getting certain loans, denied the ability to buy high-speed rail tickets, or blocked from getting your children into preferred schools. It's a profound AI-enabled shift that maximizes the state's ability to enforce compliance and silence dissent.
That level of state control just raises the stakes dramatically for personal privacy, which leads us right into the privacy battleground, digital forensics. It's an escalating arms race between surveillance and countermeasures.
The conflict is accelerating rapidly. It's moving from a philosophical debate to a purely technical one. On one side, you have these powerful digital forensics tools from companies like Cellebrite or XRY.
And these are used by law enforcement to extract data from smartphones.
They're designed to exploit vulnerabilities in operating systems to extract vast amounts of data texts, photos, GPS logs, often bypassing encryption layers on the physical device.
So what's the defense against that level of extraction? Are our standard operating systems good enough?
Increasingly, no. The countermeasures involve specialized privacy-focused operating systems like GrapheneOS and ColexOS. These are hardened OCs that significantly minimize the attack surface.
Oh.
They use techniques like verified boot and aggressive sandboxing to isolate applications. And when you couple them with privacy apps like Signal or the Guardian Project's app cloaking tool, they are explicitly designed to block unauthorized physical access and extraction, even by authorities. The goal is to make the device's data useless if it's seized.
But the sources stress that despite all these sophisticated defenses on the device itself, a massive vulnerability still remains. Where is the huge security hole?
It's the cloud backup. All your carefully secured texts, photos, and personal data that are synchronized to the cloud, Google Drive, Apple iCloud, they remain highly vulnerable to legal seizure.
So it's easier to get a warrant for the cloud data than to crack the phone.
Much easier. Law enforcement can compel Apple or Google to turn over remote data. This centralized remote storage completely bypasses the sophisticated security layers built into those specialized operating systems. It represents the single greatest weakness in the digital self-defense strategy for 2026.
That is a critical realization for anyone relying on cloud storage.
Okay, let's transition now from the digital battlefield to the literal planetary battleground, the environment and our energy future. The first major trend here is the electrification pivot and the rise of China. And the sources predict a global economic tipping point where clean energy decisively undercuts fossil fuels by 2026. And this is driven by market forces, not just government mandates.
This is a fundamental market-driven economic shift. It's being fueled by the rapidly decreasing manufacturing and deployment costs for solar, for wind, and for sophisticated battery technology.
Well, it's just becoming cheaper. The projections suggest that by 2026, the continued decline in the levelized cost of energy for renewables will make them the dominant, most economically viable energy source worldwide, even without major subsidies. And once the economic argument is stronger than the environmental one, the speed of the transition just accelerates exponentially.
But this shift has immense geopolitical implications, particularly in elevating the influence and power of China. Why does China dominate this clean energy future?
Because they currently control the entire supply chain, from processing the raw materials all the way to manufacturing the final product.
So it's not just making solar panels.
No. China's influence is growing because of its overwhelming dominance in the global battery supply chain, especially lithium processing and cell production, and in the manufacturing of affordable electric vehicles, or EVs. It's expected that by 2026, the majority of vehicles sold inside China will be electric.
Which cements their position as the leading global clean energy superpower.
And the leading technological exporter in this domain. The West, having largely ceded control over battery manufacturing and critical mineral processing, now faces a significant geopolitical challenge in securing its own supply chains.
Moving beyond energy infrastructure, let's talk about the biological response of our planet to rising CO2 levels. This is the phenomenon of rewilding and CO2 enrichment, which sounds like a climate contradiction.
It is a profound and complex contradiction. On one hand, you have rewilding initiatives, which are large-scale restoration efforts aimed at natural carbon absorption. But at the same time, the sources highlight a surprising observation. The Earth's ecosystem is getting gradually greener.
Especially in semi-arid zones.
Right. And this is partly due to the increased CO2 levels, which have risen somewhere between 45 to 50% since the Industrial Revolution.
So high CO2 actually acts as a massive plant stimulant, the so-called CO2 fertilization effect.
Yes, in the short term, the CO2 fertilization effect is real and it's measurable. Plants are just more efficient at photosynthesis with more CO2 available. This greening effect is undeniable. But the long-term effectiveness of these rewilding initiatives for mitigating climate change remains highly uncertain. The complex interplay of rising temperatures, increased CO2, and erratic rainfall. It introduces nutrient limitations and water stress. And furthermore, a greener but drier landscape dramatically increases the risk of massive destructive wildfires.
So we're seeing a beneficial short-term greening, but it's set against profound long-term instability.
And unpredictability, exactly.
And if we can't rely solely on natural systems, then the conversation inevitably turns to the most radical intervention possible. Geoengineering, playing God with the planet.
Geoengineering involves intentional, large-scale human intervention in the Earth's climate system to directly counteract global warming. You're essentially trying to hack the climate.
And it's profoundly controversial.
Precisely because of the potential for massive, unpredictable, unintended consequences and the extreme geopolitical risks that come with any one nation acting alone.
What are the specific actionable methods being discussed for 2026 that we really need to understand?
The main proposal is called Solar Radiation Management, or SRM. This involves injecting reflective aerosols like sulfates or calcium carbonate particles into the stratosphere to reflect a small portion of incoming sunlight back into space.
Acting like a temporary dimmer switch for the planet.
That's a great way to think of it. Another method is marine cloud brightening, which uses sea salt spray to make low-lying marine clouds more reflective.
Why are the geopolitical risks so high with this?
Because the effects are uneven. If one nation or even a private actor engages in SRM, it could alter weather patterns globally. It might cause a drought in the Sahel region or destructive flooding in Southeast Asia.
And the sources mentioned startups like Make Sunsets.
Yes, which is trying to do a kind of DIY release of aerosols. It just highlights the immediate danger of this technology falling outside of any international consensus or regulatory oversight. It could easily trigger diplomatic crises or even conflict over weather control.
Finally, in the energy space, there is the eternal, elusive promise of nuclear fusion advances. Is 2026 the year we finally move past the decades of promises toward reliable, clean fusion energy?
The progress is real, but the timeline remains fiercely debated. On one hand, you have massive international government collaborations, like the $40 billion ITER project in France.
Which is focused on massive scale.
Massive scale and long confinement times. But the real potential for a breakthrough is actually being driven by the private sector, specifically with smaller, more compact reactors.
What's the advantage of a compact reactor?
Private companies, like CFS Commonwealth Fusion Systems, which is partnered with MIT, are exploring new technologies like high-temperature superconductor magnets. These allow for much smaller reactor sizes while maintaining the immense magnetic field strength you need for plasma confinement.
And what's the key milestone for 2026?
The key metric is achieving what's called Q equals 1. That means the reactor generates as much energy as it consumes to operate. Moving toward commercial viability means achieving Q greater than 1 in net energy gain.
So getting more out than you put in.
Exactly. While widespread commercial deployment is still a huge challenge, achieving that critical energy gain milestone by 2026 would be a massive step toward realizing the dream of abundant clean energy.
We've covered everything from space to solar dimming. Now, let's look at the dark side of technology. Security and warfare in the digital and kinetic age. For decades, military and defense industries have focused on these high-cost, hyper-sophisticated platforms, you know, billion-dollar bombers, million-dollar missiles, but the sources suggest they have gravely underestimated drone warfare, the new low-cost threat.
That's the critical intelligence failure that the sources identify. Defense planners just underestimated the complexity, the speed, and the democratization of drone warfare development.
The whole focus has shifted.
It's rapidly shifted away from those high-cost, exquisitely engineered platforms toward cheap, customizable, and ultimately expendable first-person view, or FPV, drones. The barrier to entry for kinetic warfare has just plummeted.
And the sources provide some shocking statistics on the sheer scale of this FPV drone revolution, heavily influenced by real-world conflicts.
The scale is staggering. And it's because FPV drones rely on readily available off-the-shelf hobby components. It makes production and customization fast and decentralized. The sources note that one side in a major conflict is producing 20,000 FPV drones monthly.
20,000 a month, built in-house.
While receiving an astonishing 450,000 FPV drones monthly from international civilian and commercial sources.
450,000, that's unbelievable.
That massive disparity highlights the new calculus. The future of warfare is defined by mass production, by saturation, and by AI-enabled swarms, not by individual high-cost platforms. The ability to rapidly customize these cheap tools just completely undermines traditional military defenses that are based on expensive interception technology.
And the threat is clearly moving from the air to the ground, targeting familiar infrastructure. Let's talk about car terrorism and cybercrime's next frontier.
This is a direct consequence of that cognification of things we discussed earlier. Vehicles are no longer just mechanical devices. They are mobile, connected platforms running millions of lines of complex code.
Which makes them the next major vulnerable target for cybercrime and cyber warfare.
The sources predict a scenario where, by 2026, cars can be hacked remotely, turning them into kinetic weapons.
But how deep can a hacker's remote control really go into a vehicle's systems?
Deep enough to seize all the critical functions. Modern connected vehicles rely on dozens of electronic control units, or ECUs, and they get constant over-the-air updates, which creates numerous vulnerabilities.
So a hacker or a terrorist could remotely manipulate the engine, the brakes?
The engine management, the brakes, the steering, and the GPS navigation. The sources emphasize that the transition of vehicles into these connected information platforms has created a vulnerability that is the perfect vector for mass terrorism or cyber warfare.
Leveraging the vehicle itself, a 210 projectile, as the weapon.
As a kinetic weapon against civilian infrastructure or high-value targets.
Our final security concern in this deep dive relates directly back to the ethics of AI. It's the rise of what the sources call the AI charlatan. And this really speaks to the total erosion of trust in digital media and identity.
The threat is existential to digital authenticity. The AI charlatan is someone who leverages the explosive power of generative AI tools.
Things like 11 Labs for voice cloning, Synthesia for video deepfakes.
Exactly. Or Midjourney for images, alongside LLMs for creating highly customized persuasive text. They use these tools to facilitate fraud, identity theft, and manipulation on a globally scalable level.
And the problem isn't just that deepfakes exist, it's that they can be customized instantly for millions of targets.
That's the critical point. Previously, this kind of fraud required specific social engineering or access to high-end media production. Now, the AI charlatan can target millions of individuals simultaneously with highly personalized, hyper-realistic content.
A voice clone of your CEO asking for a wire transfer. A text message that sounds exactly like a trusted relative in distress.
And it makes deception trivially easy and globally scalable. It leads to a profound crisis of digital authenticity.
So if we can no longer trust our eyes and ears online, what's the necessary countermeasure? How do we maintain security?
There's an urgent need for a completely new paradigm in identity verification. The sources stress the absolute necessity of adopting zero-knowledge proof technology and digital credentials.
Zero-knowledge proof, how does that work?
ZKP allows you to cryptographically prove that you possess knowledge of a fact, like your identity, your age, or your security clearance, without actually revealing the underlying personal data itself.
So you can prove you're human, or over 21, without exposing sensitive data that an AI charlatan could then steal and use to impersonate you.
Precisely. It is the cryptographic solution to this crisis of deception. This technology is critical to countering the massive customized fraud threat posed by AI, allowing for verification while protecting privacy, and hopefully rebuilding a necessary layer of trust in our online interactions.
What an astonishingly dense and illuminating look at the world accelerating toward 2026. If we try to synthesize these 20 scenarios, three massive collisions really stand out as defining features of this near future.
I agree.
First, there's the collision of Earth and space, which is being driven by the economic imperative of Artemis and the intellectual pursuit of solving dark energy.
Second, you have the collision of biology and technology.
Mm-hmm.
We see that in the regenerative power unleashed by menstrual stem cells and the preventative promise of AI-driven precision medicine.
And finally, the collision of automation and ethics. Everything from the thorny, unprecedented legal fight over AI personae and the hyper-efficiency of AI lawmaking, all the way to the immediate low-cost kinetic threat of drone war. The unifying theme is just radical acceleration.
And that speed, which is accelerated by global electrification and the rise of AI-driven systems in absolutely every sector, it requires a fundamental redefinition of our most basic human and societal concepts. We aren't just adapting our current systems. We really have to redefine what it means to be human in relation to work, to ownership, and even to our planet's stability.
So we leave our listeners with this.
Given the immense power shifts forecast, from the rise of tech patrimonialism globally to the sudden, unpredictable democratization of military capability, what existing institutions or foundational concepts, beyond those we've explicitly mentioned, maybe things like currency, education, or democracy itself, will be completely upended by 2026? That is the profound and maybe destabilizing thought we leave you with.
Food for thought, indeed. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the wired world of 2026. Stay informed, and we'll see you next time.